Hello and welcome to the Winchester Post podcast. My name is Jason McEwen and I'm joined by Tim Penfold and Alan Scott to talk all things Bradford City. It's January, it's the midway point of the season and the Bradford City roller coaster is certainly in full flow. We will analyse the state of the Bantams nation in early 2024, reflecting on the season's mediocre run of form and what the likely double departure of Harry Lewis and Jake Young would suggest about the financial health of the club. We'll discuss the January transfer window plans in general and the intent to reduce the size of the squad, plus what's missing the team right now that we think should form the priority this month. We'll also talk about the early impact of Graeme Alexander since taking charge of the club just over 2 months ago. And after announcing his retirement last week, we'll pay tribute to James Hansen for his memorable career and amazing heights he achieved wearing claret and amber. Thanks as ever for your messages. We put some questions out on Twitter and we've had a massive amount of responses. Actually, there's no way we're going to get near how many there is to go through, so thank you so much. We'll go through the best of them as we go along. Welcome as ever to Tim and to Alex. This is our first podcast for 2 months, and on the last one it was just me and Alex. Tim, fair to say it's been a fairly memorable period for you?
Yeah, I mean, in fairness, I can't remember half of it due to sleep deprivation, but yeah, my son was born a couple of months ago at about the time they were recording the last podcast. So I have been somewhat busy and sleep deprived since then.
If you can only remember half of the last 3 months, can you remember the half that we were good or the half that we've been on a leisure trip?
Unfortunately, I still do remember the Bradford City games. My kid is obsessed with them, though, because it turns out if you get the sort of bright lights and moving colours on a TV screen, he'll just stare at it for a bit, and that includes football. Poor kid.
But bodes well for the future, or maybe not for the poor kid, as you
yeah,
say.
I was going to say. For him.
What are you signing up for there? Okay, let's get into it. So I'll be honest with you both. When it came to planning this episode, I didn't really know where to start. I mean, so much is going on, isn't it? There's so many talking points. I think we could easily do a three-hour special, and we'd still probably run out of time to talk about the Jamaicans, Omar Dahlia and Donovan Ricketts, as we like to do. So there's lots to get through. So let's...
Jace, can we start with the car going through all the mud at the moment? Because does that feel tenable to you?
It's a bit tense, I've got to say. There's a few bits where you feel, is it going to make it off the pitch? It's very dicey, definitely. So, yeah, there's a...
All-weather tyres for the car. That's where the Lewis fee's going.
Absolutely. But let's begin our discussion with the general state of the club right now, and we'll branch out into other areas. Tim, feels like a bit of a loaded question, but how are you feeling about the way the season is going?
Well, I'm not hugely impressed. I mean, it is... worryingly, almost exactly how Alex predicted it would go last summer, in that there'd be issues with the recruitment. Lewis and Cook would not hit the heights of the previous season, particularly Lewis in this case, and we would struggle. Hughes, because he's suddenly unpopular, would get the sack, and then we'd completely change course and go for a completely different sort of manager, I mean, I'm not sure if the neck ache I'm getting is from all the long balls or from the whiplash in style from going from Hughes to Alexander, but either way, it's a massive difference. And therefore, it seems like some of the squad that we've recruited isn't actually useful for this style. Some of it is, because we didn't recruit that well for a possession-based style. And yeah, it's just been messy all the way through. And sometimes you think we might get back into it. You know, we had a good run, albeit there were some games against, you know, literally children in the Nobody Cares Cup, where Tyler Smith got plenty of gold.
Johnny Payne, give it his real name. Come on. Nobody Cares, kill, honestly.
I mean, to be fair, if we win the next round, then I might start caring a little bit.
Yeah. And Alex, I mean, Tim, my next question was going to be that, you know, you predicted this, didn't you? As Tim says, I go back to the summer and you very much, pretty much everything that's happened this season, you said was going to happen. So, I mean, apart from telling us what the lottery numbers are going to be next week, I mean, how, I guess you're not surprised by any of this, are you really?
Yeah, I'm feeling a bit like, you know, the Simpsons episode with the asteroid, where Homer predicts that it'll break up on entry and then everyone's just like, I know, I'm scared too. To be honest, it doesn't take much though, does it? It doesn't take much to predict that things would go a bit wrong, we'd panic sack him and then do what we always do, which is the opposite of the thing we did last time, and then you'll scramble around and next season will be the one until we sack him in January and replace him with a ticky-tacky guy, and then it'll be the season after. That's going to be the one.
I mean, we've gone for an experienced League Two coach this time. Can we see if we can start making a list of possession-based coaches, up and coming, not a huge amount of experience, maybe non-league? I mean, basically Mike
Mike
Williamson,
Williamson,
but for yes, but for about January next year, because then we can have a shortlist and be straight away and ready to go, rather than waiting 5 weeks while we give it to a caretaker again.
Well, MK Dons get rid of people really quick, so like maybe if they get promoted, have a bad start, sack Mike Williamson, we can get him in next.
So you're saying that's what's going to happen next, Alex. I'll make a note of that, and we'll talk about this in October. That'd be great. In all seriousness, though, Tim, where are the problems? What is it that's going this season that's so wrong that's caused everything to just be like it is at the moment?
I mean, there's on the pitch and off the pitch, isn't there? On the pitch, weirdly, looking into it today, the underlying stats suggest we are a fairly similar team to last season. And, top half with possible playoff contention in sort of the expected goals. But last season, we had an excellent goalkeeper who meant that our XG stats, at least for the first half of the season, we were basically keeping out more goals than we should have done. And then we also had a striker on incredible form. Cook's form has gone down to merely good. He's still scoring goals and still popping up and being very useful. Lewis's form dropped off a cliff, to be fair. Statistically, I think it was the Opta model that said that he basically conceded about five more goals than he should have done based on the shots faced. And that really does knacker you, because that could, 5 goals down, that could be 5 or 6 points better off. And that puts us where the underlying data models put us, just outside the playoffs. So, yeah, last season we were a top half team with a brilliant striker and goalkeeper. This season, there's been struggles in the goalkeeper department. It's a good rather than brilliant striker, and we suddenly end up lower mid table. So that's mostly what seems to be happening on the pitch. Off the pitch, there's a lot of questions about recruitment, despite, it seems like last summer seemed a bit of a mess. We recruited for 352, and then there was that article, was it in the I paper, which basically said, oh, and then we had to scramble around because Hughes changed to 343 in pre-season. He did that because at that point Oliver was injured and so was Smith, and we were down to just Cook and Derbyshire as striking options. So he didn't trust Derbyshire to play 90 minutes week in, week out, so he went to one striker and changed things around. But that didn't sort other bits of the squad. And we also seemed to sign someone for left wing back who wanted to play either attacking midfield or on the wing, so had to scramble around for another wing back, who is honestly really a left centre back. Richards, he's mobile, he gets up and down well, but he doesn't really create. So there were still holes in the squad for the 3-5-2, especially at wing back. And then, yeah, we changed things and scrambled around a bit, but still didn't do what we really needed to do late on in the window, which was get cover for Cook while Oliver was out. Because otherwise, you risk burning Cook out, because that is one of the reasons he's not quite firing in the same way this season. So, yeah, there's issues about the recruitment, despite all the excuses. And that's why, even when we've had a bit, we've sold Lewis on and got a bit of money for, developed an asset and sold him on. But there's not, and we're going to do that with Young, although I would question whether we've developed the asset or whether Swindon have, and we're just profiting off their hard work. Thank you very much, Michael Flynn. Pity you had to pay for it with your job. And so we'll get a decent fee for that. But do you really trust us to replace them that well?
We'll talk about recruitment a little bit. But yeah, I think just widening that in, Alex, I mean, recruitment's a massive issue, isn't it, really? But if you're looking at the club at the moment, probably almost you've got Stefan Rupp, obviously, as the owner. There's a bit more questions about him and about his long-term ambitions and whether he's involved enough, whether he's actively running the club enough as he should be doing. You've got Mark Hughes, obviously, criticism of him, and he got paid with his job. You've got Stephen Jenk, criticism of him, and you've got Ryan Sparks, criticism of him. It does feel to me at the moment that only one person has sort of paid the price for their influence and their shortcomings this season, where there's not much accountability going towards the other people involved with that. Does that seem right to you?
Yeah, I mean, it seems accurate. I'm not entirely sure whether it's the right answer. I mean, I can see, as Tim was saying, they've tried some things in preseason and just haven't worked. You know, they could see, we said this last year, you know, that the Lewis was never going to be as good as he was again. Cook isn't going to be as good as he was again this time, just on numbers. You know, it's just math. But they've tried to compensate by that, but you change your system. You go three at the back. We can maybe be more defensively solid that way. And I think they have been more defensively solid. And you can think about, could it bring some, get some better performance out of Jamie Walker, which I think they have got. I think he has been better this year. I think Brad Halliday's been a lot better this year, especially over recent months. They've got some improvement, and you bring in other players who can score goals. Alex Patterson looked good when fit. Walker's got more goals. Smith has chipped in with some goals. They have done things to try and compensate for the regression. It just hasn't worked to the right extent. And I think ultimately, Patterson being injured and Walker being injured at the same time is just a killer. So in terms of the plan, you can see the plan that they tried to do. It hasn't really worked. It doesn't really feel right that the manager is the problem, because I think what we've seen over the last few months is with Alexander, I think, is a good manager. Hughes, I thought was a good manager. They've both shown that they can get a bit of a run of form out of the team, but the team's just not there. You know, they're not consistent enough. They're not. That's just not who they are. You know, this team isn't going to be a team you can rattle off a really consistent run of form. Like the end of last season under Hughes, we went when we brought Clayton in and we came quite defensive, but we didn't lose for ages. And we were drawing some, but they were very consistent just again and again and again. This team just can't do that. They just don't have that in them, which is, you know, you can change the manager. It hasn't changed the overall position. You know, we're sort of where we were when we sacked Hughes. We're sort of in the same position. I don't think it was the manager. So I think they've made the person accountable that's easiest to make accountable. And they did that. They're sort of where they started. It's not really the problem. It's the players aren't there. You know, this isn't the player squad. So, you know, if you're trying to find the actual person accountable, you know, it's probably not the person they got rid of. But, you know, I'm not sure what he's going to do at this stage. You know, I think they're probably wouldn't say so publicly yet. But, you know, we're 4 or 5 weeks away from planning for next season. You know, and that's where the bigger questions need to be asked, I guess.
Yeah, and on that, Tim, I mean, there's plenty of been, as Alex is talking about, there's been a lot of transfer activity. It feels like the resources are there as a club to have obviously managed this a lot better. And now there's talk about, you know, trying to recover deficit. So if anything, we've spent too much money on players and too much on recruitment and have little to show for it. I mean, what do you make of it?
I mean, it is a bit concerning that we're now having to get a deficit back. You know, we had we didn't really have an FA Cup run, did we? But we had an okay League Cup run and a decent crowd against Middlesbrough, so that will have brought in some extra revenue. We'll have made so far about, I think, about 100 grand from the Football League trophy. Thank you, Tyler Smith. And so that, you know, we're getting in money from cup runs a little bit, and yet we're still running a bit of a deficit. So it does concern me that they were, what was the plan, you know, in the summer? Did we, you know, we may have spent a bit more, but surely signing a kid from Aston Villa and a kid from West Brom hasn't completely put us over the end of the budget, especially when it was obvious that we were two or three players short going into the season still. You know, it suggests that there were issues with the way it was spent further back in the summer.
Yeah, and we don't know about it. You know, we don't know the ins and outs, but we can say that it's been reported by Mark Douglas, right, that the money is being spent to cover an overspend, and he's sort of, you know, relatively well plugged in. And as you were saying earlier, Tim, Harry Lewis is a really good piece of business. You know, you take a guy, can invest in him, try and make money off it, develop the asset, which is good, and it is good work. But all of that good work has been spent to cover a deficit, where we've just got a bunch of loanees and kids in, and we've now got a squad that's too big and it's not going anywhere. We've wasted it. You know, the only, if you look at all the transfers towards the end of the window that we've got, the only one of them that's a young asset for the club is Lewis Richards, which I guess is part of that overspend, was bringing him in towards the end of the window. So you've got one young asset out of it. But if all of that money is now gone on the overspend, you know, what's the point? You know, and his replacement is a 32 guy we got a free transfer, you know, so it's like, you know, so what? It's gone now. There's nothing left.
Yeah. I think that's the problem, isn't it? Is that, you know, the idea that you bring a player like Lewis, you develop him, you give him the opportunity, and he does really well, and you sell him for a considerable profit. I mean, the reportedly 175k, which, bear in mind, was a free transfer, is a decent profit. And I think supporters would be more bought into that if they then saw that money being used on bringing the next lot of people through who'd be like that, or signing it on someone who can make a big difference to the team. But the idea that it's to cover up past mistakes or past recruitment overspends, meaning it's not going for anything positive in the future, that's just where it just feels really disappointing, doesn't it, really? A question probably looking at kind of the structure of the club, and you go back to some of the comments that Derek Adams made when he was interviewed in terms of, you know, the biggest club in some respects in the league, but kind of off the field, probably the smallest club in the league in terms of infrastructure. And we talked about it a bit before, Tim, but there is that lack of probably support there and for Ryan Sparks this moment in time, that, you know, he's out there doing it on his own. He's got a Stephen Rupp is a distant owner who's only got so much interest and influence, and he's kind of left there on his own. And Leon Hobbs tweeted that, I won't read out all of Leon Hobbs' tweet to us, because Leon's quite a direct, blunt guy, and a few swear words in there along the way, but he mentioned, you know, one of the things to help fix the club is to get shut of associate directors and appoint a proper board of directors who are paid for their knowledge, insight and expertise, including a well-qualified director of football. Obviously, that's easier said than done, because that will cost quite a bit of money, Tim. But is it just lacking that kind of expertise at this club? Is that the problem, would you say?
I think so, yeah. It feels like there isn't any sort of overall strategy rather than spend the money and go up. You know, there's a strategy on the commercial side. You can see that. And, you know, increase commercial revenues so we can spend more money and hopefully go up. It's just that there's this sort of gap at the spending the money and then going up stage, where the football expertise is just lacking. And it's just, as a result, there's, you know, you could see it when we sacked Hughes, because honestly, we knew from basically the Morecambe game that sacking Hughes was going to be a possibility. Once we got battered by Morecambe, there was like, there is a risk that this goes badly downhill. There was rumours that he was going to get the sack after the Harrogate game, which we drew. So that was a couple of weeks before we actually pulled the trigger. And then we get to it and we go, right, what next? It's like they didn't seem to have a plan, and the fact that we've appointed someone who was still in employment at the time that we sacked Hughes, eventually having been turned down by, quite publicly, by Danny Cowley, and seemingly wanted Kevin McDonald to keep the job for a bit, only for him to say, no, I'm not ready, and then for results to sort of back him up when we collapsed at MK Dons and Sutton. So it feels like there wasn't really a strategy there. The general overall strategy of, you know, the sort of, there's almost a sort of whiplash, like I said, the whiplash in playing styles. You know, we went from, and it's been there for a bit, it's like Stuart McCall's there, so he, you know, club legend, and then he gets the sack and Truman and Seltz come in, and we're all of a sudden about developing our younger players and developing these talented coaches and so on. And then suddenly we have another wobble and we sack and we bring in Derek Adams, who is not about developing young players and is more about promotion at all costs. The football's not brilliant to watch. He's quite abrasive. So then again, we sack him and we bring in Mark Hughes because, you know, and the other option was Richie Wellens. So it was like people who play decent passing football and aren't going to just annoy absolutely everyone and so on. And then we go again and it's like, well, that passing football didn't work. All we did was pass it sideways, you know. And so we must therefore switch and go to Alexander. And the exact, you know, just, it's like, it's very much like actually England managers from the mid-2000s. You know, we had Sven-Göran Eriksson, who we was brought in because we needed the foreign coach expertise after Kevin Keegan just wasn't good enough tactically. Only he was, you know, just wasn't English enough, was he? So he had to bring in Steve McLaren, who was just a bit too matey with the players and not tactically good enough. So let's get in a foreign disciplinarian in Fabio Capello. But, oh, he was just too tough and never really got it. So let's go in and get Roy Hodgson and so on. And they haven't really stumbled across a strategy until almost appointing Southgate by accident and then getting something from there. And the same thing happens with our managers. We just go from opposite to opposite to opposite. And so, of course, you end up with a squad that seems recruited for about four different managers, although it barely seemed like the squad was recruited for Hughes, considering he wanted to play possession football, but we never had a midfield passer who was good enough to do that after Watt left. Hence the quite spectacular stats on when we had a lot of possession and never used it. So some parts of this squad are better out of possession. But then we've also got this very promising youngster, an asset to develop in Bobby Poynton, who could be worth a lot of money if we do this properly. And we've hired a manager who doesn't seem to want to use him that much or pay that much attention to developing younger assets at the moment. And so there's a risk that we don't develop him properly. And yeah, we just sort of veer from one course to another without ever working out what the correct one is.
Yeah, absolutely. And on that, we put the poll out there on our Twitter account, asking supporters, do you feel confident in the ability of those who run Bradford City to make good decisions? And we had a great response, 1,115 votes. 7% said yes, 12% undecided, and a resounding 81% of those people said no, they do not feel confident in the ability of those who run Bradford City to make good decisions. And on that, Alex, I think there's a real disconnect, isn't there, right now with supporters and the club, and it feels quite painful in terms of how fans are feeling and how the club are not really reacting to that.
Yeah, I mean, they're losing, right? They're not doing well on the field, and you know these things always happen. The thing that is worth keeping an eye on, so we're recording this on Monday night, so the Tyreek Wright signing has just happened, so that is positive. I think people will be positive about that, which is good. And you know, so there's an opportunity on Saturday, you know, with a new signing, and get the crowd and get a decent win, and you know, things could pick up again. So I don't think anything's fatal. I don't think people are against Alexander. I think Alexander's quite well received so far. I think he's sort of okay. The challenge is that I keep continually just adding things to your point, Jace, that I think you made a couple of weeks ago, as we saw with Adams, and we saw with Bowyer, and we saw with Peter Taylor back in the day. You can play pretty boring, dour stuff to a point, and if the results aren't there, it goes away, yeah, and the fans are going to turn on you. And the fans turn now, if you look over time, in like ever-decreasing increments, the fans turn quicker and quicker and quicker, because this is just, again, it's the same thing happening again. We're in the same... this is like the Gary Bowyer story again. You know, we're already there, we're just doing it on a speed run, we're just doing it a lot quicker than we did it last time. Because of just the consistent chopping and the changing and the chopping, and there's no plans, as Tim just very eloquently outlined, that we don't need to go through again. But you know, there is, it just keeps adding and adding and adding to the same thing, and it feels like everything's speeding up and speeding up and speeding up. And you know, it wouldn't be beyond the realm of possibility. You know, I think I tweeted out when he was appointed that if you took the average of the last like post Parkinson managers when Alexander was appointed, and just that is the amount of time that we'd expect the managers to be, we'd be looking for a manager again in about June. And it wouldn't be beyond the realm of possibility, right, if the season peters out, that actually, you know, Tim, we haven't had a club legend in ages. Mickey Flynn's kicking about. Fits the bill. Yeah, do that in May. You know, that is... that's
stretching the definition of club legend there.
Club.
But, yeah.
You know, he played for City-ish.
Benny Carboni's now got a job, so he won't be in the papers begging for the chance.
And ironically, and look, I'm a big fan of Tyreek Wright. I think it's a good signing. We'll talk about it later. I mean, it's a good sign. It has an opportunity to make things good. But ironically, we've signed a player for Hughes now. We're signing players for the previous managers, not the future. We normally sign players for like two managers' time, which is like Verdane Oliver's like finally coming into his own now. But we're signing a manager for the previous guy, that's not the strategy. You know, at least stick with the thing that we're good at, which is signing someone for Michael Flynn to play next December.
Absolutely. Yeah. We'll talk on transfers very, very, very soon. But just one more bit on the off the field bit before we move on to that. As I say, talking about the mood not being great, there's a lot of talk, you know, a lot of fans would like to see more communication from the club. They'd like to hear more what's going on. Calls for a fans forum. And there was a note from one of the supporters who's part of the supporters board who had put that question to the club recently, asking for a fans forum. And the club have said, no, there won't be a fans forum because we did one at the start of the season and there's no plans to do one again until next summer. Now, looking actually on the Bradford City website itself, on its own club charter, it says, and I'll read it word for word, Bradford City Association Football Club will arrange a minimum of two general meetings of supporters during the football season. These events will provide an open forum for any supporter who wishes to attend, with the club being represented by at least one member of the senior staff and one representative of football management, plus other staff as a club shall see fit to address specific matters on the meeting agenda. Tim, does it, I'll added sort of let sell in the short here a little bit. We know if that's their state of them to have at least two a season, and there's a lot of questions at this moment in time, is it reasonable to expect a bit more communication on what's going on at the club?
Yeah. If it's in their charter, they should be looking to do it, because communication between the from the club to fans has been poor for a while. And, you know, there's a bit of a, you know, Stephen Rupp is never going to be someone who does a lot of talking to fans. You know, that's fair. There's plenty of owners like that who just are, you know, they own the club and they hire people to run it and they do the talking. But Stephen Gent doesn't seem to want to talk to people. Ryan Sparks doesn't really seem to want to talk to people. You'll see him, you know, every 6 months when we appoint a new manager. And then, yeah, he'll say that the guy was first choice, you know, no matter how many people have turned him down first. And I think that actually does speak to another bit here, which is that people don't trust what the club is saying. And you've seen it on the Jake Young stuff. And I appreciate that the club could, you know, firstly, he could be injured because Swindon would have been incentivized to play him injured. They don't need to think about him long term if we're going to recall him in early January. So they may as well get 75% fit Jake Young. But, you know, we all know that if he plays for us, he can't leave until the summer. And so, of course, he's incentivized to turn around and say, no, I'm not playing. I'm going to take this move. The club, if they want to sell him, are incentivized not to play him. But we're doing this little dance around, oh, he's definitely injured. You know, Graham Alexander would, as no one, it was this quite specific line, no one has told me that I cannot play Jake Young or something like that. And that sounds like quite a specific denial of, no, I've not been told directly, but I have, but I am aware that, you know, if I play him, he can't be sold, and then I don't have any money to spend on new players that I might want for my tactical system. He might be pushing for a move and not being hugely cooperative about training or playing at the moment, because that the rule of only being able to play for two clubs in a season incentivizes that at this point. You know, Jake Young quite reasonably wants to make the best of his career and therefore take the decent contract in League One and step up while his stock is highest.
Yeah. We'll go and talk generally in a second then, but just quickly before I do that, we had some tweets out there. We asked people out there, what are your views on this, how the season has gone so far? We had 55 responses, which is definitely a record for that question. So I'll just read out a couple of selections of that. Aidan Flood says, poorly, 14th in League 2 should always be considered a failure. You can't really hide from that after 27 games. Adam Baker says, uninspiring when we end up with a squad of 30-plus players yet somehow fail to address only the three or four positions needed last summer. Rob Hunt says, it's just another wasted season of playing in this rubbish league. More promises unfulfilled by the club and those in charge. Chris says, Peter, we're now into a boring, mediocre mid-table season, and I'm bored of watching us. Kiwi Bantam says, this is exactly the season we should have had after blowing our best chance of years to go up last season and botching our approach in the close season. Hangover was palpable on the pitch from game one and quickly spread into the stands. Callum says, underwhelming to say the least, very inconsistent for the most part. Some good performances, but usually followed by dire ones. Mark Sudden says, think we are paying for poor recruitment, but lack of clear plan from the club. Communication lately has been poor, and the odd time we do get information, it's just cliche spin. Fans are seeing enough promise and jargon spin now. Clear and regular communication needed going forward. Chris Miller says, very disappointed not to be able to build on the reasonable foundation from last season. And Matthew Knott says, we have a bloated squad of average players. It was only going to go one way, nowhere. And that leads us on to talk about January. And let's kick off, I think, Alex, with talking about Harry Lewis. And we've already talked, obviously, a little bit about the profit that's been made on him. In terms of that decision to sell him, what do you make of it, bearing in mind his performances last season and this season?
It's a shame. I liked Harry Lewis. I think from the club's perspective, he had another 18 months on his contract, I think, so he was here for next season, not after. If you'd taken the... I think you can reasonably take the decision. If they weren't going to give him another contract, League One level, top of League Two level, one of the highest paid keepers in the division, if they decided that they weren't going to give him that contract, which, given his form this year, I think is a defendable position for them to take, then it makes sense to get rid of him now rather than waiting to the summer, because 6 months down the line, his value is only going down at this point just because he's getting close to the end of his contract. So if you've taken the decision as a club, we have scarce assets, we don't think investing in a keeper at that level is worthwhile. We've already got a lot of money invested in Andy Cook, Tyler Smith, you know, all Richie Smallwood, all of our 19 centre defenders. You know, we've got a lot of money spent elsewhere in the club. Probably don't need to invest it. We can get a replacement level keeper who's just kicking around like Sam Walker, who we think is fine, for much less money. I think that's like a totally reasonable strategic decision for them to take. So if they're going to cash in, now's a good time to do it. If you were going to cash in, would they have got more? You know, if they were in this position, would this be something that they would have got more in August? You know, probably. But in August, they could have had reasonable expectations. He did perform better. They could have had reasonable expectations. They were going to be in the playoff hunt, so you wouldn't be selling him at that point. Now we're in a season where in mid-table, it sort of makes sense. So I think I can understand from a Carlisle perspective, might help you stay up. Even if he doesn't, you come down, you've got a pretty good keeper for next year and you've got some money and they can afford to pay the contract where we can't. So I think it makes sense for everyone, sort of a good move for him. Sad to see him go, but, you know, it's fine, isn't it? I think it's just a shame to see him go, but his performances this year, I can see why they wouldn't want to give him the contract that he wants.
And on the arrival of Sam Walker, Tim, I think there's two ways of looking at this. So I'll give you the negative slant on it. Is he's come in there basically, and there's been quotes straight away from Colin Doyle saying what a great lad he is and having played with him at Kilmarnock and knowing him from there, which are well intentioned, but perhaps come across that it's a bit of a job to mate thing, and obviously the club have been stressed, can stress that's not the case. He's been a target since the summer, but if that is the case, bearing in mind if we had to believe that, and I've no reason not to believe that, what does it kind of say about Graham Alexander? Because he wasn't here in the summer, but we're bringing in a goalkeeper who we've been wanting to sign since the summer. Does that say much about who's in charge of transfers?
I mean, I think a couple of people did withdraw from the managerial race because they weren't getting full control of transfers, apparently. That's just from what I've heard and might not actually be accurate, but there were some people who were initially linked and dropped out. It's whether it's just Alexander's happy to work with the scouts and goes, right, Lewis is going, who have you got this list? Okay, I'm happy with that, let's go. Because Walker being on the list, he was available in the summer, ended up as a Charlton backup, and then we've gone for him again in January when we could. So potentially there is an argument to be made that transfer control shouldn't be fully with the manager, because then you end up with the squads that we've ended up with, that have been built by four different managers and are a complete mess. It should be with someone who knows what they're doing, definitely, and that's where there's still a lack of confidence at the moment, because after this summer's recruitment just gone, it doesn't seem to have worked, and therefore the faith in the recruitment team has been shaken somewhat. But yeah, I think there's also a bit of frustration about his age, just because we've developed this young asset in Lewis, we have sold him on, and then Sam Walker is never going to be a saleable asset. Never. You know?
Yeah.
The most we'll ever get from him is a Colin Doyle-style quid. And so that's fine. Maybe we can put the money into signing players to develop elsewhere. If we could get right permanently in the summer, for example, that is another asset we could go and develop. But could be worth something, could make a profit, could take us up the leagues and improve with us. But at the moment, it's like we've sold this asset and then we've replaced him with someone who is very much not an asset to develop and sell. I mean, you could say it's a bit like Wells and McLean. We had this young, promising striker we developed. We sold him. We went big in on the experience, although McLean was much more expensive than Sam Walker would be, and much harder to get rid of as well, I suspect. But, you know, it's the same sort of thing of we have developed this young asset and now we're not doing it again.
Very, yeah. Very small scouting support on the extended highlights that I've seen of Sam Walker so far. Very tall. Tick. Good for Alexander. Yep. It'll be good for a last-minute corner if you need to stick him up there. Very tall. the only other thing that was notable, because he didn't really have much to do on Saturday, conceded a goal, though I don't think it was entirely his fault. One of the big selling points of Lewis was his distribution. Good on the ball, in a huge style defence where you're trying to keep possession, a very, very important part of the team, a sort of cog of the team that he could pass with both feet, and he was good at throwing the ball out, and he was sort of good. That was his sort of skill set. That's not Sam Walker's skill set from the short sample size that we've seen.
He did shank a couple of clearances.
Yeah, that's not his game. But under Alexander, that's fine because you're wasting Harrison Lewis's ball skills with the ball at his feet in an Alexander team because he never used them because he was just banging it along to the cook. So if that's what you're doing, you actually don't need that. So if sacrificing that bit of his game actually might, under an Alexander team, might make a lot of sense. Next year under Michael Flynn, he might struggle.
Yeah, and just a quick note on the maybe on the positive side of this arrival and kind of the fact that it may not be Graham Alexander's decision. It's worth reflecting back in 2016 when Stefan Rupp and Edin Rahic first bought the club and we had a very good window, brought a lot of good players, and it was very much seen as a team effort of who recruited who. And actually Colin Doyle himself, when he arrived at the club, because the goalkeeping coach at the time, Steve Banks, recommended him and had previously played him, so it's not unknown to do it that way. So it's worth perhaps saying that there is perhaps a positive to that. And I think Graham Alexander himself in the press conference last week said he's not an expert in goalkeepers, so he's trusting other people. So if he's happy, obviously that's a good thing. Moving on to Jake Young's situation then, I'll stay with you, Alex, to talk about that. In a way, it feels like the club can't win on this one, can they really? Because there's not really a way they're going to look good out of this, other than perhaps getting a really good fee or playing him and him scoring 20 goals between now and the end of the season. But it does feel a bit messy and not great at this moment in time, and probably going to an inevitable conclusion that he's going to go to a League One club for a fee that fans will probably think isn't enough.
Yeah. And in fairness to the club, it's just awkward. You know, it's just an awkward situation. You know, they've found themselves in a situation where they can't really do right for wrong. I can't really think of a way that they could have handled this much better other than saying, look, we've recalled him. He's not going to play for us. He's on a leave of absence. We're going to sell him this summer. And I can understand why you wouldn't do that, because it is a clear signal to the rest of the world watching. But the rest of the world watching aren't idiots. They can see the signal. They can see the fact that he's not playing. They can't pretend here. Everyone can see through what they're doing. So, you know, potentially do something like that. But, you know, it's a difficult position. They're clearly going to sell him, especially given the transfer activity they've done so far this window. You know, there's not a squad space for him anyway. So it's just, I can't really think it doesn't seem feasible that they've had a couple of offers so far that I think have been reported by the TNA, right? I think they've had two bids that I think have been reported that they've turned down. So clearly the bids at the minute aren't where they want them to be. If sides at the top of League One, bottom of the Championship, thought he was an asset, he was a player who could reach that level, he seems very easily gettable. And the fact no one is easily getting him makes me think that I'm not sure scouts rate him as highly as perhaps we might. But given the financial situation, you know, again, we're going off reports, but if reported that we've got a deficit, that you would cash in, wouldn't you? So they'll try and get what they can get. I think it was reported in the TNA over the weekend, Carlisle, sort of with Harry Lewis, is the one that makes sense. And again, they've got some new owners, they've got a bit of money. They can, you know, roll the dice, see if he's any good. And if not, they get a good League One player, League Two player for next year in the same mold as well. So it's very sensible. They would fit the bill very well. But they're probably not going to get them the money that people would have hoped for. And if there was more riding on the season, if we'd have continued that run that we'd have had over December and we were like eighth now, maybe you say he probably is worth keeping and we can take a run at it. Given we've faded away, I think that's made the decision for them, where it's like, it's just a waste because we're not going anywhere anyway. And in that case, you just take what you get and move on. But again, like the conversation we were having earlier with Harry Lewis, you got a young asset here, you bought a young asset on a 4-year contract or 3+1-year contract so that you can develop and then sell him to be cashing in because you've got to, and the money's spending, covering an overspend anyway, and helping you fund a loanee from Plymouth who you're not going to keep, you know, is, again, it's when you do a half, when you do a half-baked strategy, you're half in, you're half out, you don't really get anything, do you? So that's a shame, but, you know, they found Lewis last time, they found Young last time, maybe in the summer they can find the next. Maybe.
Yeah, and on that, I was on that theme a little bit. We've already talked about Tim, but Gray Alexander was interviewed on Thursday, asking about the situation and kind of if he can and cannot play Jake Young. And you've obviously already talked previously about some of the things he said there. But interestingly, he said at one point, "I'm not the boss of Bradford City. I'm the football manager. I try to keep my focus and influence on the things I'm supposed to." It feels like it is a situation that he really does have limited say on, doesn't he? Because if he talks about he would play him if he could, but realistically, if Young was somehow fit to play on Saturday, would he be allowed to play him? And you know, is that a decision taken out of his hands, really? And is that a sign of this is where we are now as a club, where we don't give the manager that level of control, they have to accept certain decisions?
I mean, it might even be, even if he had a full level of control, if I were in Jake Young's position, knowing that playing 20 minutes for Bradford City would lock me out of a potentially very lucrative and good for my career move, I would be saying I was injured, potentially, you know? That's just the nature of it. And so the only way I can see him playing for us again is if we somehow get to the end of January and no one has made an acceptable bid, and we haven't, and we decided not to rush into a sale. But I'd be surprised if that happened. I think Alexander knew what he was getting into. I think he knows that, you know, this is the way football clubs often work these days. The manager having absolute full control over transfers. Not convinced that's a, you know, that does lead to quite a lot of the issues we've had with changes in strategy and so on. It worked for us with Phil Parkinson, and it worked really well right up until he left, and all the infrastructure for actually running the football side of the club went with him. Yeah. And honestly, we did so well that summer, bringing in Stewart and Greg Abbott and people just to run everything. It could have gone really quite badly wrong. And to be honest, once those people were bypassed, Nedim Rajic took control of transfers, it did go very badly wrong. You still ended up with sort of squads that were recruited for about six different people, and it was still a bit of a mess. Whereas in theory, if, you know, you can decide this is the way we're going to play with someone outside who's not just the manager in charge of transfers, and go, this is what we want this club to do. This is how we want to play. This is what we want to do. You know, we want to play a certain style of football. We want to develop young talents. And then you recruit and hire to that model. And that's what the very best teams, the ones who punch above their weight, do. But I'm not convinced we do that particularly well, because we still end up going from different style to different style, from someone who wants to develop youngsters to someone who doesn't want to develop youngsters, and so on. So, yeah.
The really frustrating thing for Alexander, the thing that would really frustrate me if I was him, that I wouldn't say publicly, but you know, I can understand why you would say it privately. He came out in the paper this morning saying, we're not clinical enough. We have lots of shots. We have chances. Andy Cook missed a good area on Saturday that could have put the game 2-0 up, and that would change the game. They would have to come out. We'd be more sort of effective on the counter-attack. Like, that's the step that is missing. We just need someone next to Cook who's more clinical than what we've got. And he's got the best striker in the division that you could put there and do that, and just do that thing. And it would be like the missing link in the team. And he came out very publicly, and said, this is the problem with the team. This is the thing that we're missing. And the exact player that you would sign to fill that hole for the team is literally the guy he's got in his squad that he can't play. And it must be so frustrating. If I was him, I'd be very frustrated that if they'd have won a couple of the games they drew over Christmas and we were eighth or ninth, if I was him, I'd be like, give me him, I can get us in the playoffs. And you know what? They might have gone for it. But because they've fallen away, they lost two or three games over Christmas, and then they're like, you're not getting in the playoffs, mate, and this is money that we can't turn down. And it's gone away from, and he was this close, he's that close, and I bet he thinks deep down, if I'd have put him in the team, I could have got the team in the playoffs, and I've not been allowed. And that would be the thing that I would find incredibly frustrating. And through his comments that he said in the media this morning, you know, clearly he's frustrated with the players that he is allowed to play, that they're not taking the chances that's in front of them. And you know, adding the best inside forward in the division to Andy Cook is a very good way to compensate for the fact that Cook is missing chances that he was taking last year. You know, that's exactly what you need. And you can't play him. It's sort of Shakespearean in its torture of Alexander.
Yeah, it really is. A couple more questions on January. We've got still loads more to talk about yet, so let's just wrap up January. The first one, and a bit about that interview as well, Alex, you talked about, but I'll put this to Tim, where he talked about again needing to trim the squad, needing to move players out. There's too many players there, and it's deflating for people who are nowhere near the squad. It kind of felt a couple of weeks ago, Tim, that it was very obvious who was going to lead because they were just not anywhere near the first team plans. The result against Derby in the Pizza Cup or Johnny Paint Cup or No One Cares Cup or whatever you want to call it, just not the sponsor's name, obviously. That's changed things a little bit, hasn't it? Because people like Harry Chapman, Sam Stubbs, back in contention, Bobby Poynton as well. It feels a bit more messy now, doesn't it, really? But clearly he's got to get rid of players. Who do you think is likely to leave between now and then? Or who would you think should go?
I mean, the obvious one, given that we actually have a bunch of attacking midfielders, and if we are switching to a 3-4-3, which we have done for the past couple of games, there's not really a space for him. Osa Davy, he's just really not good enough. And the fact that he got in ahead of Odwar, ahead of Poynton, ahead of Chapman, Poynton and Chapman are possibly a bit further forward than the 3-5-2 system really wants them to be, but they'd still do a better job than Osa Davy, who was offering absolutely nothing. I'm a little surprised Tulloch hasn't gone back. I suspect that there is some potential issues like West Brom aren't letting us terminate the loan. That could be without someone to take it over. So there's, you know, we might be stuck with him for a bit. I was half expecting Chapman to leave because, again, not really a vacancy. I was half expecting Stubbs to leave and then suddenly he's back in the side. See how long that lasts for. I'm not convinced that he's a left of a back three defender. I think he should be in the middle of a back three. But, you know, he got himself back in the team with a good performance against Derby. So did Chapman, so did Poynton. We'll see if they continue to do that or whether he switches things around now we've signed Tyreek Wright and whether we go back to sort of a 3-5-2 with Wright up front alongside Cook. So, yeah, some of the sort of bigger earners that we half expected to see go haven't gone. There is rumours that Verdane Oliver might be off, which, again, considering that he has been used as just the extra big man, suggests that we might be looking for a replacement big man so that we can go big man up front for the last half hour and create absolutely no chances while launching the ball miles in the air, just like we always seem to do when chasing a game. But there's a good, you know, there's a better chance that Chapman stays or at least consider staying. We'll see where we are at the end of the window because another couple of bad results and they might be back out the team and looking for moves again, you know? So
it's very similar to where Watt found himself a couple of years ago when they brought in Adams, didn't he? If you're Chapman, you ain't signing up for this. You know, it's not what he came here for. It must just be so at this level, it's so fragile. People's careers in this so fragile. You get the right manager and you've got a real good chance and the manager changes and you're just stuck.
I could see Chapman going to somewhere with, you know, a bit more of a footballing manager. You play him off the left in a 4-3-3 or whatever, and I can see him being one of those wingers who gets double figures. He could easily step up to League One, and decision-making wise, that's his problem. But, you know, he's got the talent to play and to do quite a lot. But, yeah, it's where you've ended up with the manager playing quite a direct 3-5-2, there's not really room for him in that system, and then he doesn't get games, and it's just a tactical misfit.
Yeah. And finally on that, Alex, before we move on, Tyreek Wright's back. There's a positive. Come on, we haven't talked about that, have we? So that's exciting, isn't it?
I think it's a good signing. You know, I live on the same street as a Plymouth fan who sort of watches him most weeks, and he was like, he's not really broken through. He's quite similar. He's like the Chapman thing. He doesn't really fit what they do, and they've got a sort of really very expensive, highly thought of left wing back at Plymouth. And he doesn't really have a spot because his best position is coming in from wide, or in a front two, and he's not really capable of playing in a front two in the Championship. So he sort of again has fallen between the cracks a bit. So it's a good signing. Good to bring him back. He wanted to come back. He gave a nice interview this evening about how he's really motivated to come back and make up for leaving last year, which is really nice to see. I think he'll have a good impact, and I think with him playing up front with Cook, they did it a bit, didn't they, Tim, before he left that December?
They never played him up front with Cook. He had two games up front with Oliver.
Oh, now we're talking. So he could bring big Verdane could be back in.
Yeah,
back
if he doesn't leave for where he might be being linked to leave with.
But he played as the little man in a big man, little man. mould in a front two, right?
Yeah, he did. Two games. This is where I think I'm a little bit concerned about there being a bit of a tactical misfit again. Just because he played up front for two games and did well. That was in a diamond system, so basically it was all on him to do the width because the fullbacks aren't getting as far forward as wingbacks. So he was sort of, you know, Oliver played very centrally, Wright just went and overloaded one flank or the other with the fullback. And yeah, that can work, and there's a role for that in 3-5-2 as well. It's just he did it for a couple of games and was mostly more effective as a winger, and we're not playing a system with wingers.
Given the travails that we've had in our sort of attacking left back, left wing back position,
I don't think that's his position. He's troubled quite badly.
No, but I wonder whether I agree. Although I would kind of like to see him as a wing back. But the have it being the overload in the left hand side, giving you a more attacking coming in off the left, just sort of floating out to the wing from the position in the front two, like you were saying, sort of providing an overload. There's an opportunity there, I think, to make us more dangerous. I'm not sure how it helps us score more goals, I'm sorry. But I mean, that is a potentially something to look out for, I guess, that he can definitely do that position more than Tyler Smith can, right? Because that's certainly not his game coming in from wide.
Yeah, I mean, Smith at the moment is playing as purely a poacher, and he's getting chances, and he's not scoring them. He's actually, if you looked at the Opta stats, higher expected goals per 90 minutes than Andy Cook.
Really?
0.4. Open play, yeah, 0.4 to 0.34. Only Cook is taking his chances and Smith is not. He has been in the Football League Trophy. So yeah, switching from Smith to Wright, Wright's not going to do that sort of poaching. But he will get more involved in the build-up because Smith really doesn't, and he'll create more. So it might be a good thing for Cook if this partnership works, because the focal point for goal scoring will just be Cook rather than Smith. And then, you know, Wright and Walker or whoever will be expected to chip in, but the focus will be Cook. And that's possibly better for us than the focus being Smith.
I was going to say, in some combination, if you've got Cook, Walker and Wright as your front three, that's pretty good, isn't it, I think?
Yeah.
And especially where
if we played a 4-2-3-1, you can also add Bobby Poynton or Harry Chapman to that.
Yeah, that'd be nice, wouldn't it?
You're not getting it launched in a 4-2-3-1, mate. He's not going to go for that.
Have to actually pass the ball, which will be a shock, wouldn't it? Anyway, we asked the question on Twitter, what would people like to see happen in January, which people interpreted in different ways. James Pieslek says, a takeover, but that isn't going to happen, so I'll opt for something a little less wild and ask for some general competence on and off the pitch, please.
Less
sounds
wild?
A bit far-fetched.
James,
Mike Scott says, progress in the Football League Trophy, it's the one remaining hope for this season. Paul Hodgson says, sell Jake Young, get rid of Osadebi, O'Dwyer and Smith, sign extensions for Jamie Walker and Poynton. Chris Miller says, I'd like to see a clear and obvious plan about Alexander's vision for the squad moving forward, and hopefully the rest of the season will show how we can compete at the top end of the division next season. Del Rio says, get the right starting 11, consistent performances, Graham Alexander to know his squad and deploy effectively. Paul Garsai says, back Graham Alexander to recruit the squad that he needs to get us into League One, even if that means realising current playing assets now or in the summer. Mike Foy says, a strong end to the season at home is vital for season ticket sales. The sale of Lewis and Young will meet Sparks' KPIs, but do little for our recruitment kitty or ease fan toxicity. Callum says, statement of intent, if not, at least communicate as to what the plan is. The lack of communication and mixed signals regarding Young, etc., makes it very frustrating. BCFC fan says, the Jake Young saga needs to be resolved with either us accepting a respectable bid or, if not, keep him. He can't just pretend to be injured for the rest of the season. Also, we need to strengthen in the left wing back position and on the wing. Ben Wood says, I'd like to see us keep the better players, extend those that have played well and contracts are nearly up and get rid of the dross in the squad. Mark says, clear the decks properly now, regardless of how that leaves us looking. This season is done. Do proper groundwork now for the summer. Michael Brett says, massive cull of those who will not feature due to the system. For example, Wilson loaned out, lack of quality, Asadebi, injury record, Oliver, and or temperament, O'Dwyer. And finally, Banter Peak says, just a couple of wishes and a dream. Wish one, a speedy and satisfactory resolution to the Jake Young situation. Wish two, City in the player positions following the return of a fully fit Jamie Walker. The dream is for a more contented fan base with matters both on and off the pitch. I think we'd all agree with that, Banter Peak, even though that does sound a little bit far-fetched at this moment. moment in time. That moves on to talk about Graham Alexander, who's obviously come up a lot in this conversation, but we haven't really reflected too much on what we make of his start so far and his tenure in charge. He's now been at the helm for 14 games. He's won 7 of those games, he's drawn 3 of them, and he's lost 4 of them. I'm going to start with Tim because, well, maybe we're starting a negative here, but I don't think Tim is too impressed with Alexander so far.
I mean, here's what I expect him to be: a pretty direct manager of, you know, standard League Two. There's some bits which I've been quite pleased with. The team press is better. The team looks better organised and better coached. But there's stuff that's frustrating me. The treatment of Bobby Poynton quite a lot. It just seems like an absolute waste of a promising young asset, and increases the chance that Poynton just leaves in the summer for a compensation fee. And I really don't like the way that our response to anything is just to go more and more direct. Just get another big man up front and then wonder why it's not really working, because Oliver's won the flick, but Cook's nowhere to be seen because he's never really had the game of running on to flick-ons. So there's that. I've seen nothing to convince me that we shouldn't have gone for Mike Williamson, and I will continue banging this drum, mostly because he's had such a good start and I can actually be a little bit smug about being right, which is a rare event. But, you know, I suspect I think Alex mentioned it earlier, there's a better chance the fans are going to turn just because of the style, because if he's not winning and we're suddenly not winning again, and a lot of the win, you know, had 7 wins, yes. 3 of them have been come in a cup competition that no one hugely cares about. One of those, in fairness, was an impressive win against Derby. Barnsley reserves and Liverpool under 21s, not really.
Oh, those Liverpool 19-year-olds didn't know what hit them, mate. They didn't know what.
Well, they did. It was Andy Cook.
Alex, what do you think? Are you more positive about him so far?
I'm more positive than Tim. I mean, he's fine, isn't he? I mean, he seems capable. As Tim was saying, the main thing is they look organised. You look him and Luquet, they can organise a team. They clearly can structure a team. It's pretty low risk. You know, they've sort of looked at what they were like under Hughes and realised that, you know, that is the team isn't capable of playing that style. So let's just simplify it, get it forward, work it out from there. You know, they're getting lots of shots, you know, they're getting forward, they're getting the ball in the box, they're not holding onto possession, you know, the team is sort of suited to that, and that's all in the sort of run of form that they had. I do like how he gets people close to Cook. I think that was one of the challenges that Hughes had, especially towards the end, where Cook just got so isolated and he was having to come so deep just to get in. Even with Poynton and Chapman on Saturday, they were playing so narrow, and that was where the goal came from, you know, that Poynton was just stood literally right next to him and sort of was able to get it back to Cook, who scored, you know, so that is positive, and it's attacking, and you know, that's kind of good. The squad doesn't seem entirely what he would really want. And do I think he's a better manager than Hughes? Probably not. You know, he's different. I don't think he's necessarily better. So it's a bit, you know, it's frustrating, isn't it? It's sort of that we're going to have another season now going down this style. Might work, might not. And in a year's time, we'll probably be doing something else. So I think he's all right. He's done well. He talks well. I don't mind him. I think he's fine. I think we can definitely get promoted with him, which is the test. So he probably won't be this year, but you know, maybe next year potentially if they recruit well.
Yeah. And on you've touched on it a little bit there, Alex, in terms of not being too sure about the squad. Tim, it feels like he's kind of got this inner circle, isn't he, of players, certainly up before the Derby game anyway, it's fair to say, that a certain group of players he trusts implicitly. He'll always play them because he doesn't really trust the other players. And it meant his team selections haven't really varied, have they? And, he's got a set way, hasn't he? And he's already really tied to that, isn't he? And partly that's because of personnel, it seems to be.
Yeah, I mean, he had the thing of, you know, he'd pretty much decided that he wanted to try the Cook and Smith pairing. And from there, it's like, right, we're playing 2 strikers. You sort of go back and it's either 4-4-2 or 3-5-2. And he's found 3-5-2 works better because you get less overrun in midfield and so on. And it has worked for a bit. But yeah, when Walker got injured and then Patterson at the same time, that was the point where we got quite surprised when Poynton wasn't getting any game time, because it's an attacking midfield role. He's got the skill set for it. And yeah. And then when Derbyshire got in over Poynton and Chapman and then played in an attacking midfield role, was it against Crawley? That seemed a bit bizarre. But it seemed like he'd completely made his mind up. And then suddenly he hadn't made his mind up, because we had been poor for a couple of games, and he swapped out the team against Derby, and Chapman and Poynton and Stubbs all did pretty well, and so did McDonald, actually, and was a bit unlucky not to play, although harder to find a place for him if you're keeping Smallwood and Gilead in the team. And suddenly he's giving players a chance again. It'll be fascinating to see what he does on Saturday, whether he decides that, actually, no, back to 3-5-2, right up front this time, Odwar in the midfield three, Poynton and Chapman relegated to the bench or beyond, Kelly back in, whatever. See if he reverts to type or keeps trying a 3-4-3.
The thing to keep an eye on this year, we were talking about this the other day, Jace, that when Cook and Walker have been in the team, they've been good. They've like genuinely been good. They've been like, when they've both been playing, we've been a really good side. The frustrating thing, I think, is that we've got a squad of so many people. But if one of those players is missing, they're so fragile. The whole thing, the whole structure is so fragile. And the turn in form completely coincided with Walker getting injured, you know, almost like instantly. And they can't find a way around it. You know, maybe Wright gives them that. But I think the frustrating thing for Alexander is, well, the thing to look out for, I guess, over the rest of the season, if when Walker comes back and he can stay fit, the form picks up and they perform well. That's something that you can build on, I think. But without Walker, as Tim was saying, we've got so many attacking midfielders that he doesn't know which one to pick. You know, he's played Osadebe for a bit, he's played Odwell for a bit, he's now got two of them in there with Chapman, trying to make something work. And he hasn't been able to find it yet. And given that we've got so many players in that position that he can't get any of them to do the things that he wants to do, that Walker was doing, he's frustrated. That's the frustration, I think, from his perspective.
Yeah, and elsewhere in the team, Alex says, some players have been thriving, and I think it's fair to say you're a fan of Tyler Smith, so it's probably better asking you about him rather than Tim, who's less convinced. And Brad Halliday's done really well as well, and John Tomkinson, so there's been some positives there, hasn't there?
Yeah, Halliday's been excellent. I mean, he would probably be, if we were doing a mid-season player of the year, it's probably Brad Halliday.
Yeah.
And I thought he was a sort of surprise, because he was on our list last year, right, on the end of the season. Is that right? He was sort of fourth, I think, or fifth in our voting last year, from memory.
Yeah. Sort of best of the rest, wasn't he? Yeah.
Yeah, which I thought was sort of a bit of a surprise. But he's been excellent under, like, the being able to give him the licence to get further forward, I think, sort of really helped his game, and defensive cover behind him in Tomkinson, who's like, it puts him in a much better position, I think. So that's positive. And you know, I think he has, I think Gilead and Small's been pretty good, set piece delivery aside. And Gilly has played well, and the back line looks pretty good. I think there's a lot of positives to take out of it. It's just that they're just so reliant on Cook and Walker. And Walker is just, ever since he's been here, you know, he's just not, and before, actually, you know, he just doesn't really stay fit. And that's why you get Pattinson, because it means you've always got one of them. But then Pattinson's been out, and he's out for another 3 months, I think. Like, he's had another setback, I guess. So he's out until April, and, you know, at that point, you know, what's the point? So it's probably going to be next season until we see him back in full fighting. Like, that's the frustrating thing, that they actually did try to prepare for it, and it's just not worked. The plan, you can see the plans that they tried to deploy, they've just not worked.
Yeah, looking at some of the underlying stats, Tim, and we'll just touch on them briefly. There has been a notable difference since Alexander took charge in terms of average possession has gone down from at some of its peak under Hughes towards the end. We were averaging about 59% possession. Now it's 48% possession. The passes has gone down massively. Average passes per game, the average long balls per game has gone up from about 80 per game at the start of the season to 89 now. But the biggest thing probably is shots for and against. It's really gone up a lot more in terms of average shots on goal. We've gone up to 15.1 when it was down at 11.5 towards the end under Hughes, and the average shots against now is down at 9.3 when we were conceding an average of 12.4 at the start of the season. So what they're showing is we're having less of the ball, we're having more shots on goal, and we're attracting fewer shots at our goal as well. So they're, you know, there's something there, isn't there?
To a degree, yes. Possibly. It depends on the quality of the shots, and I'll point to Saturday as an example. We had 22 shots against Colchester, and what was it, 3 on target, expected goals of 1.1 from 22 shots. So that was a lot of low-value shots. We've had quite a few games like that. Crew springs to mind as well, where we just... And Barrow as well, where we had quite a lot of shots and so on, but we didn't actually create any good chances to a degree. But yeah, there's other games where, you know, we've had chances and missed them. That's... and Crawley stands out there, where Tyler Smith missed an absolute sitter in the first half, and there were some decent chances in the second half as well. Cook had a good one, as well as missing the penalty, although that didn't really matter once their guy had fumbled it into his own net anyway. So, yeah, the underlying stats, I think, are a bit better. It's just that we still have a habit of getting sucker punched, ending up behind in games to a degree. That's happened a bit recently. It happened, you know, Morecambe, Crawley, Crewe, and I mean, even Doncaster. We sucker punched ourselves with a bad error and then got ourselves back into it. And sometimes that will lead to the stats that you see when one team has got themselves ahead early and is just trying to hang on. You get that team not really attacking and the other team just going for it and having lots of shots but not necessarily good ones as they try and break a down defence. And that's something we've been poor at all season, breaking down a mass defence. And to be fair, for quite a while, we haven't been good at it for a long time.
It's always like a game of balance, isn't it? Because this was the thing that doomed McCall in the end was that he would always attack more because he couldn't convert. Teams couldn't create the good enough chances to convert, so he over-attacked and left himself open at the back. And then Hughes, by the end of it, you know, really struggled to create chances. We had Cook, which sort of helped balance that out. But, you know, we were very good defensively under Hughes. We had the best sort of open play defence last year. The good thing that the promising thing from Alexander that I think, and it is sort of Adams-ish in that they create a lot of shots, but they don't really give much away because they play so low risk in the back third. They get it forward quickly. They don't mess about, they just try and get rid of it. They're pretty good defensively in open play, not as good as they were under Hughes because they have less control, they have less of the possession, you know, like the Hughes key was that they had so much possession they controlled the game in a way that the Alexander teams don't, but they're still pretty good at restricting chances. They've just lots of these small amounts of chances have been going in because Lewis hasn't been playing well, and you know they've just been conceding lots of goals. And they do create chances. He has found a balance. They are quite sort of stingy defensively and still create chances at the top end. You know, so there is something there to build on. It is very Derek Adams-y. This is always his model. You know, you sort of restrict chances, have lots of shots, and then try and scramble things in. That's always been his model. So it's very similar to that. But as we saw with Adams here last time, if you get on a bad run, chances don't go in for you. It's terrible to watch. The fans will turn, you know. So that's the path we're on at some point. We'll end up there. I'm not sure how long it'll take to get there, but that's certainly the path we're on with Alexander.
Yeah, it goes back to a point you made before. You know, we create lots of chances. We're good at the back. If only we had the second highest scorer in the division who could come in and play and make a difference. If only, you know. Wild idea, that, isn't it? So we've had loads of response. So I'm just going to go through some of the quick tweets in terms of what people are making of Alexander so far. And I think it's fair to say a fairly few mixed reaction out there. Matt Brooks says, Alexander, I don't think he's very good. Clearly was about third choice. Looks in his recent interviews that he's been sold a pup, kept in the dark over Lewis Fee, for example, and his football isn't very good. James says, think I'm generally in the minority, but I've been unimpressed even during our winning run. His team selection, substitutions and lack of plan B worry me. Andy Holland says, really like him, a good manager, needs to build his own squad, done remarkable under the circumstances. Silver Banter says, seems pragmatic, has tried quite a few formations already, he must be given a chance. Sean Moore says, he appears to be the man who knows the lower leagues and has identified the problems with this club and squad, but he's been gagged into saying exactly what he thinks. I suspect he's a man who won't put up with it for long. Seems like he doesn't suffer fools gladly, so a few need to watch out. Andrew says, honest, down-to-earth and thoughtful guy, complete change of style from Mark Hughes' era. However, without better quality players in and around the box, the long ball style has its limitations and Graham Alexander started to look uncomfortable when interviewed post-match. The pressure is on. Fabian says, I think he's made the side more effective with the players he has available. He's the right man for the job, in my opinion, and reminds me a lot of Phil Parkinson. He could be the one to finally get us out of this division. Mark says, good bloke, could do well. Did he know what he was letting himself in for? I think not. Shocked that he didn't know the fee that Lewis was sold for. If that's true, it's disgraceful. Does this raise the fear that Graham Alexander is a gaffer's man? I fear that it does. And final one for now. Sam says, honest and pragmatic, goes a bit too quickly to long ball though. I think his hands are tied with the players he has inherited. Just really quickly touching on where we are in terms of the league position and the season. Tim, we're 7 points off the playoffs as we record this. We're 16 points clear of the bottom two. Mid-table mediocrity is the diecast. Are we just destined to our fate now?
I'm pretty confident we're going to finish about 12th. Basically, there's no chance we go down. There's enough about the team for that. And there's a small chance we can sneak 7th. If we recruit well for the rest of January and suddenly the shots start going in and, you know, we're not conceding this off. Say Walker turns out to be an upgrade on Lewis just by keeping out the shots that Lewis wasn't keeping out this season and so on. There's a small chance of 7th, but I'd be surprised. I think the main focus should really be on the... and I know I said I didn't care about it, but, you know, if we can get ourselves, you know, we're in the quarters now. That's about the time that you start thinking quite close to a day out at Wembley. And that would be, you know, firstly, it'd be nice to have a day out at Wembley, as long as it's not against the one under 21 team left in the competition. And, you know, secondly, day out at Wembley, 40, 50,000 fans there, half of that crowd, that's a decent amount of cash for us, isn't it? It's a war chest for next season. And possibly even, you know, the possibility of winning this, it's a good thing for a squad to get into the habit of winning trophies and know what it feels like. I think it was Brian Clough who said that, I can't remember, I think it was like the Anglo-Scottish Cup or something like that, first thing his Nottingham Forest side won. And he always used to credit that for the run they went on, where they won the league and they won league cups and they won the European Cup twice. And it's like, these group of players, they got used to the taste of champagne and they wanted more.
So what you're saying is if we can win at Wembley this year, we'll be winning the Champions League in a couple of years' time. Is that fair? So, yeah, okay.
Give it a couple more years than that, you know? But, you know, and playing points and more, and then we'll definitely do it.
I'll want to see Andy Cook lifting that trophy. That'd be great. Alex, looking at the fixtures coming up, it feels like it's now or never almost in a way. These next few games are absolutely pivotal to our season because we've got Doncaster on Saturday, 20th in the league, then Salford after that, 21st in the league. Then we play Swindon, who are 15th, who are dropping, have just sacked Mike Flynn, as we talked about. And then we've got the Cup game as well. And then after that, you've got games against Wimbledon, Wrexham, MK Dons. They will be really tough games. There's Sutton. But then there's also Barrow and Notts County after that. So it feels like if you don't start winning some games now, that's it. Forget it, basically.
I think that's right. As Tim was saying, there is an outside chance that they can make a move because they've got the players to do it. You know, if you're going to make a move like that, you need like your centre forward to go on an amazing scoring run. And we know Andy Cook can do that because he did it last year. So they definitely have it in them to go on a run. But if they're going to go on a run, it needs to start like now. It's a lot harder to catch up teams who are winning than it might seem. So they've got to start now. And as you say, you've got to beat the things that are there to be beaten. And we saw on Colchester on Saturday, they're the games that they struggle in. Then they have for a long time, for the specific point that Tim made earlier, when teams sit in against us, we don't know what to do. Because we haven't known what to do for 2 years now. And you know, these are the games that they find harder. If they can get through these games, get a bit of confidence going, get some points on the board, then when they have to be a bit more counter-attacking and direct and against the better teams, they're actually pretty good at that, and they have been pretty good. So if they can get some momentum going, they can build something. It's definitely an outside shot, but they need to start on that. As we saw against Colchester, these are the games they struggle. So you think you would think they're the easier games, but for this side, they're not.
Yeah. We shall see what happens there. There is so much more we could have talked about in this episode of the podcast. I feel like we barely scratched the surface, but we did want to end by having a bit of a talk about James Hansen and paying tribute to him after he announced his retirement last week. A career at Bradford City that, you know, was absolutely utterly memorable. 286 starts for the club, 49 sub appearances and 91 goals. So many famous goals as well along the way that we've all talked about recently and we've all watched again many, many times. And I thought probably best rather than go through those things again and what was the most important, Villa or Leeds, etc., because we've done that sort of stuff to death. Let's just talk about what he achieved in general at the football club and kind of how remarkable his tenure was. So, Tim, if I start with you, your sort of main memories of James Hansen, the guy who started on trial in the pre-season game, having obviously done well at Guiseley, survived five different managerial tenures at Valley Parade and you know, continued to thrive.
I mean, I can remember the frustration that he didn't score that many goals, but he really did help the rest of the team around him. I mean, it was especially true with Wells, but he was someone who was selfless, especially for a striker. He would put the team above his own needs. He'd run himself into the ground for the team, create space, cause problems, never give defenders a moment's peace. And, you know, we remember the big goals, but you just remember the sort of hassling and harrying and difficulty. Because, you know, the big game in recent times that you don't talk about Hansen in is Chelsea, because it was John Stead who stole the show there. But where was James Hansen that day? He was playing a bit out of position. He was giving a young Anders Christensen an absolutely torrid time, absolutely, you know, charging up and down, causing problems, working incredibly hard for the team and sacrificing his own game for the good of the team. And we got a famous win in part because of that, you know? And that was very much Hansen. He had a brief spell after Wells left when McLean wasn't working of being the main man. And it's a little bit sad because I think it came out, it was in one of the TNA articles that he got diagnosed with a form of arthritis in about 2014. But that was the time, basically after Wells left until about something like September 2014 when he got injured again, he had that run where he was scoring one in two. You know, he finished that season quite well and then got a few injuries. And he started the following season really well, you know, two against Coventry, one against Leeds, a bunch of quite big goals, and then got injured again and was never quite as prolific, shunted half out to the left to accommodate Stead in the diamond and so on. And, you know, you could see he wasn't quite as mobile, couldn't quite run the same way. And I think, you know, the one sort of lingering piece of sadness is if he'd been able to stay at that level in League One, going one in two, because he managed it for 20-odd games, if he could have managed that over a full season, can you imagine, you know, that's the, you know, a big striker like Hansen scoring 18, 19, 20 goals rather than 13, 14, that could be the difference between just missing out and getting promoted. So that's the thing. But he is someone who would work incredibly hard for the team, put up with a lot of rubbish, not get the credit he really deserved at times, but he also scored these absolutely huge, memorable goals that, you know, we will always remember. The one at Burton, which cost me some of my half-time chips that I hadn't quite finished, so on. You know, Leeds and so on. We can talk about those forever, and we, I'm sure, will do. But it was just the, you know, the regular league game where Hansen might not have scored, but he headed away six corners, harassed opposing defenders, and was really quite important in us getting the win. You know, those sort of games.
Yeah, and Alex, Tim's touched on it slightly, but he was a player that a lot of fans disliked at times and didn't really rate and would be on his back quite a bit. And all that changeover, you know, things that happened, different managers came in, it was always someone who you thought, oh, maybe he'll be suffer from here, maybe he'll lose his place, maybe he'll be moved on. And he always came back and he was always first choice for every manager he played. He was someone who just showed remarkable resilience, didn't he, considering, you know, the difficulties he got even getting there in the first place, the rejection he's had as a kid at Huddersfield and at Bradford City, and then to come back in there and still have people on you, criticising you all the time, but to do the things he did was remarkable.
Absolutely. And, you know, when you can do a sort of post-career sort of look right now for him, you know, it's a fairy tale career. You know, it's sort of the thing that lots of kids who, you know, you don't grow up in a Premier League academy or whatever, but these are the stuff that you dream of, right? You know, you get to play with your hometown club for most of your career, you get to score at Wembley, score like really good, important goals. You know, he's got how many, like, you know, in the, they've got the murals around the ground and in the ground of all these pictures on the walls of him. He's like all over, you know, he's going to be there forever, you know, and that's sort of, that is forever. And you would think that, I know they have players in the sort of old form of retired players sort of going through the suites and the boxes and stuff now, and you get sort of club ambassadors and things, and you know, you think you could just do that forever, just telling stories of that team. And you know, he got to be, even at the time, and I know what you mean, it's one of the things you look back to now and you don't really like talking about, it's not really nice to talk about, but he was always a point of ridicule for so long that he's been able to come through all that and come out the other side where he is now as sort of a club legend, right? He's had top three all-time goal scorers. If Cook stays fit, he's probably going to pass him at some point, but you know he's going to be in the top five for a long time. To get that, given where he was in 2011, 2012, and the pelters he was just getting again and again and again, that, you know, to be where he is now 10 years later is an amazing achievement. And as you say, sort of testament to his resilience, really, and sort of mental strength that he was able to do that. You know, as I say, it's an absolute fairy tale career, I think, from his perspective. I think, you know, you couldn't really, if you were a City fan, you know, you can't really come up with a better career than that, I don't think.
No, definitely. Tim, I always think when, after he left City, it almost like his career went downhill and he never was quite the same again. But actually, when I was looking at and researching stats for preparing for this conversation, you know, he went to Sheffield United, obviously, from us. Then he went to Bury. He was at Wimbledon and at Grimsby. He played another 122 games in the EFL. So he was someone who, you know, maybe didn't quite hit the heights that he did at Valley Parade, but he still was someone respected outside of Bradford City as well, and someone who did a good job at other places.
Yeah, I mean, Sheffield United was very much the short-term signing to get them over the line, to get them into the Championship. And then just Wimbledon, he played a role in keeping them up. And he had a good spell at Grimsby, you know. I think, what was it, 9-29. If he could have stayed fitter there, I think he'd have done really well. He scored against us, didn't he, at the away game at Blundell Park that season. And he was, I can remember some quite frustrating things, because I can remember seeing the Who Scored Team of the Year for that season, because it was the first year they did stats for League Two, and the strikers in that Team of the Year were James Hansen and Owen Doyle. And it's like, that was the year that Doyle was on loan at Swindon scoring those, but his once you actually looked into it, his aerial stats were utterly ridiculous. He could, you know, Cook wins about half of his headers, about half his aerial duels, and he's pretty good in the air for a striker. Hansen was winning about 70%. He was just unbeatable aerially for a centre forward. He'd win everything. And then as long as you had someone who could actually run off him, and that's where Wells came in, it worked fantastically.
Yeah, it really did. Final word from yourself, Alex. How would you sum up Hansen in terms of your time supporting Bradford City and where he stands alongside the greats and the good and the bad that you've seen over the years?
He never had the... He's one of my favourite players. He's not my favourite like style of player, because I'm always going to be the sort of tricky winger, the sort of flair players, or he's going to be the ones that I gravitate to. But you know, he was a mainstay of all of my favourite teams. And you know, to your point, Jace, all these managers came in again and again and again. He was always playing, and as to your testament, they did 120 appearances after he left. You know, because managers can always find a role for that. If you try really hard and you work and you're really good in the air, you're really good at one thing. You are transcendent at one skill. Which was winning balls in the air. And that long diagonal from McArdle to Hansen is my favourite pass that we've seen. I just see it a thousand times. You know, I can just picture it in my head, and I'm sure most people listening to it can just see that pass again and again and again. And it always worked, never failed in all that time, because he won 70% of reserves. Yeah, he's a really, really good player and a really, really important part of the sort of best teams of our generations, I think. So, yeah, it'll always someone that I'm sure, as time passes as well, people always look fondly on him, I think.
Yeah, definitely. We asked the question on Twitter in terms of what James Hansen means to them, and we had a fantastic response from loads of people. Just through a selection of them, I can barely touch the surface again on these. Chris says, "He is the reason I'm a season ticket holder. I'm biased as I'm younger, so I didn't experience the times of McCall and Hendry. I consider Hansen my favourite ever City player. After Wells left, Hansen stayed and was always a solid player up top we could rely on. I love him." Rob Hunt says, "Yes, he scored some very important goals, but more than that, he did so much hard work. I remember the occasional games he didn't play, how much we struggled with him without him. More than anything, this was testament to how important he was." Neil says, "I loved how opposition managers always mentioned what a threat he was and how difficult to handle James was. Every time we went to a game with Hansen and Wells up top, you thought we always stood the chance. So many obvious standout goals, so I'll mention the Coventry injury time winner to win 3-2, which was brilliant." And Tim just did briefly talk about that one before. Boarshead Bantam says, "The true fairy story, local lad made football hero, true Roy of the Rovers stuff, club legend." Councillor Ian Parson says, "James was always 100% and he's a really down-to-earth man. He used to work at the Co-op, you know." We forgot to mention that, didn't we? I don't think people knew that. Wayner says, "James Hansen was a limited ability footballer, but he knew what his strengths were. I genuinely think that if he'd been coached better on certain aspects of his game, he could have gone to have even bigger achievements. However, he's a legend in my eyes for his City achievements." Howard Ratcliffe says, pure and simple, a Bradford City legend. I remember getting frustrated with him as a fan in his early days. He seemed to miss a lot of chances. In time, he became one of our best ever centre-forwards and scored some of the most important goals in our recent history, Villa being the best. And final word from Mark. One memory of him was being sat fuming watching Matilda in London whilst he was banging them in against Leyton Orient. Thought I'd it all sussed out to leave my missus and the kids to go to the show while we went to the football. Unfortunately, the missus had other ideas. Oh, Mark, we've all been there. Yeah, and we feel your pain on that one, definitely. Okay. Best laid plans and all that.
My best laid plan story. Do you remember when the MK Dons moved to MK?
Yes.
And so it was the Nigel Riococca thing? We went down as a family, and my sister and my mum went to go see The Lion King, and me and my dad were like, we'll go watch us play Wimbledon. You know, this nailed this. Completely forgot they'd moved to Milton Keynes, got there. Got to not in the right city. Literally had to go and try and find it in a pub, but we just went to a pub, and it's just the worst plan ever. Before we finish, Jace, you wrote an article, or you like helped with James Hansen's dad, right? That I think you reposted on the website recently. What's your lasting memory of Hansen then? You've seen... He sort of chronicled basically his entire career, right, in one sort of fanzine or website or another.
I think for me, it probably is that it's that night at Villa Park and just the fact that we just did that incredible achievement and he got to be the hero. I think that was just, it meant a lot really, because he was always one of these people that you'd watch games thinking, he's brilliant. The stuff he's doing is absolutely fantastic. The flick-ons he's getting, the way he's trying to do stuff. And people around just wouldn't appreciate it at all and they'd be giving him so much stick and you'd be thinking, you're just clueless to some people, unfortunately. You just don't understand football because he's doing absolutely brilliant stuff for his team. Yes, it's not the most finesse stuff in the world. It's not the most aesthetically pleasing stuff, but it's so incredibly effective and he's doing his doing everything for the club. And I think when you see him go through them difficulties and those struggles, I think the standout thing is when you see those great times and what he does there and having those kind of moments. And I remember just speaking to his dad a few days after that Villa game when I interviewed him to do that piece. And he just sort of said, you know, at the start of the call when we first went, you know, how pleased they were because they were getting so much just before that they, as a family, they were finding it really hard to go to games. They were getting really upset and it was just really getting to them quite a lot. So to have that moment at Villa Park, I think that really stood out to me because I just thought that was a really beautiful moment for you know, for what his family, for what they have to go through, other people near him, and then to have that moment where he's the big hero, the big star, the one who gets us to Wembley, the one on the front page of all the newspapers the next day was just absolutely fantastic and so well deserved. And just one last little final thought, one slight frustration I had was that I remember it was Katie Wyatt when she did a piece with I think with James's dad again, actually, it was after the Chelsea game. She did a little piece sort of going back and looking back on it. And had James's dad had this theory that when James Hansen got older in his career, he'd end up becoming a centre-half because he's so good at reading the game that he'd make a natural good defender. And when, as he had moved on the years, he'd become a defender, like a Dion Dublin and Chris Sutton. And I was always waiting for that after Katie told us that story, and it never happened. So to me, there's a missed opportunity there. I know we've got a million centre-backs at the moment, Graham Alexander, but if you need a spare one, maybe get James Hansen. Let's try him as a centre-back, because I would just love to see that, see what it's like.
Might be better than Ash Taylor.
Anyway, on that note, thank you so much for sticking with us. I know it's been a slightly longer podcast than normal, but as I say, so much to go through and we haven't even touched on some of them. We will be back with another podcast sooner this time rather than waiting 2 months, as long as people can get sleep at night, Tim. But thank you as ever for listening. Thank you, massive thanks to Tim and Alex. Thank you for everyone who sent in a message and voted in the poll and continues to support Wid for the Post. We really do appreciate it, and we will see you soon.
And I'm recording.
Yep. I'm recording too.
Happy days, right. Hello, and welcome to the Wid for the Post. Straight away.
One take, McEwen.